Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and also the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. This week, Pope Francis is meeting with President Obama and addressing Congress, bringing with him strong messages regarding economic inequality, mass incarceration, and climate change.
His visit is also occurring during Yom Kippur, the holiest day of the year in Judaism, and this presents a unique time to discuss the role of faith in social justice work.
So to discuss this, we're joined by Claire Markham, the Outreach Manager for the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative at Center for American Progress. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Claire. We've been waiting to get you on the show for a while.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Happy Pope NATO.
Happy Pope NATO.
Or is it Pope NATO that we're using?
Pope NATO, Pope Tastrophe. All kinds of things.
I heard Popocalypse earlier. That doesn't roll quite as trippingly.
Right. I saw on, what was it? There's a WMATA.com/Pope page and pope.dc.gov.
That's right.
Yeah, because
there's also the popeinphilly.com.
Yeah, there's a lot going into this visit, a lot of anticipation.
Mm-hmm. And maps, lots of maps.
There have to be, because I am understanding that I need to stay in and buy some milk and some bread and some peanut butter
some
and not go anywhere.
Because
it's like planning for a hurricane, that all the roads are getting closed.
Yeah.
So, okay, so all of our selfish Pope planning aside, so Claire, give us a little bit of a rundown. What's the Pope going to be doing while he's here?
Sure. The Pope is visiting Washington, D.C., New York City, and Philadelphia. He's arriving from Havana this week. It's pretty exciting that he's coming from Cuba, especially after the role he played in helping restore diplomatic relations between Cuba and the U.S. And in D.C., he will be addressing Congress. He will be visiting a Catholic Charities that serves the homeless population here. He'll be received by thousands of faithful of a number of different faiths at the White House, and he'll meet with President Obama. He'll also give a mass at the National Shrine. And when he heads to New York, he will visit a school in East Harlem. He'll meet with immigrant families and also the low-income families of students who attend the school. And he'll meet with a number of bishops and say some more masses. Madison Square Garden has never had such a holy event to be preceded, as I understand, by a number of celebrity cameos and musical experiences. So get excited for that. And in Philly, this whole visit is built around the World Meeting of Families in Philadelphia.
And he'll also be visiting a prison, right?
Mm-hmm. Outside of Philly, yeah, he'll be visiting with the incarcerated folks. And as I understand it, some employees of the prison as well.
So he's got a packed schedule, and you have a packed schedule. You're involved in a few events. What's going on inside and outside of CAP?
Yeah, people are really very excited about the Pope's visit, and we're really excited to be a part of it. The faith team here at CAP is hosting an event with a number of expert faith-based activists and Senator Markey, who will be here to talk about the Pope's call to act on climate change. And then we are partnering with a number of great organizations in D.C., Franciscan Action Network, Network, the Catholic Social Justice Lobby, and many others to rally for climate immigration action on behalf of low-income folks and against wealth inequality, any number of issues the Pope cares about a lot.
Well, and you mentioned climate, and some of what he's said has actually been fairly controversial, at least to some, in that, you know, he has actually spoken the truth and said climate change is a problem and is a science issue and is man-made. It's not just some, myth. But he's also spoken a lot about poverty and inequality. There actually were some comparisons made between the Pope and Piketty earlier this year after a speech that he made. What do you think the significance is of having the Pope speak so openly and so frequently about poverty and inequality?
I think a couple of things. I think first and foremost, the Pope is challenging us to think of our economic system as a series of choices that we make. It's not a system that popped into existence fully formed or that we have no control over, and he's asking us to be responsible stewards of that system and put people back at the center. And so Pope Francis is really asking, if we value profits over people, is the system working? And he, of course, and millions of his followers feel that it's not working. I think, you know, some of his critics have suggested that capitalism has lifted millions out of poverty and therefore the system works. I think the Pope agrees that the system has done a lot of good, but he sees its limitations. So the Pope doesn't prize growth over stability. And he certainly doesn't prize profits over people.
Well, and a particular quote of his that maybe captures the sentiment of a lot of his speeches is, "Let us say no to an economy of exclusion and inequality, where money rules rather than service. That economy kills. That economy excludes. That economy destroys Mother Earth." Pretty strong words.
Absolutely. I think that the Pope has traveled to a number of countries. He's lived in a community that was greatly marginalized from the economic activities of the greater Argentinian population. And, you know, he looks around the world and sees that many people struggle to feed their families. Many people struggle with access to healthcare and education. And he knows that that's not a Christian vision for the world.
And the conservatives who are preparing to welcome him into D.C. this week have said that they hope that he stays away from these more political messages. But obviously, you know, there's a long tradition of religious leaders caring about the poor, so this shouldn't be too controversial. But you wrote a piece recently on talkpoverty.org where you said, "Don't be fooled by his distinctly unpolitician-like authenticity or his defiance of partisan labels. Pope Francis is a savvy political strategist, so he probably won't shy away from those messages." But can you explain what you mean by calling him a savvy political strategist?
Sure. I think that Pope Francis's vision for the world is greater than any one political narrative, and it's important not to try and take ownership over the Pope's ideas in any party. But it's also incredibly important to hold yourself accountable to the values and the ideas at the center of his message. So Pope Francis has been known to say reality is more important than ideas. And when we look at our policies, if what we want to do is make people the center of our culture and we want to make the lives of low-income folks better, we have to ask ourselves, are our policies doing that? If they're not doing that, we need different policies. And I think that's something for our politicians to consider.
I also love another line from that same piece of yours. You said, "A good Catholic meddles in politics," well, right? And they're not your words.
Pope Francis said.
They're his words. But you pulled, I found that powerful.
Yeah, I think it's important to resist the idea that the Pope is a purely spiritual figure and that religious people should leave their religion at church. That's simply not the reality of the world. It's not the reality of the values, and it does not achieve the vision for a more just nation.
And what's interesting is before, you know, we started the show, we were talking about how a number of conservative politicians talk about their faith. You know, they say, as a Catholic, you know, Paul Ryan has said many times, as a Catholic, his faith informs the work that he does. But a number of these same politicians who reference their faith, you know, are put off by the Pope's message because it doesn't align with their interpretation of Scripture.
Or oppose policies that actually would combat poverty and inequality.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, I mean, it seems like a faith in politics seems complicated because you have different sides trying to co-opt the message. How do you think that the Pope is playing into this, because he's not a member of a political party?
Yeah, I think the Pope has a challenge for everybody. It's important, like I said, not to co-opt the Pope's message for any particular party. He is not a partisan figure, even if he is a political figure. I do think, again, we can go back to the values. You know, are our policies reducing poverty? Are our policies making people's lives better? Are they increasing access to healthcare, to education? If they're not, we're not doing it right. And it's important to hold people to account on that.
So we mentioned at the top of the show that this week is also Yom Kippur. And so what was it we heard earlier this week? Another Pope NATO-like thing. It was, I don't know if it was Pope Kippur or something like that, right? It's a collision of a lot of faith this week. And something that you strive to do in your work at the Center for American Progress is to work with interfaith coalitions. Why do you think that it's important to work in an interfaith way when it comes to social justice?
Yeah, interfaith coalitions are incredibly important. Pope Francis often talks about building a culture of encounter, and I think the reason he emphasizes encounter is he knows that relationships, knowing people, coming to care for them is how we combat the fear and marginalization of being isolated and separate. And I think that our interfaith coalitions, in their many different traditions and their many different practices, find a number of common values that they share across faith and also with many people of conscience who don't practice any particular faith. So focusing on those communal values, the dignity of the person, the value of family and community, economic security as something we care about, that helps us work across faith lines. It helps us amplify our shared values and our common message, and it helps us be more effective and well-supported.
So is it fair to say that people of all different faiths are excited about the Pope's visit and not just Catholics?
Absolutely. I think Pope Francis has kind of multicultural, multi-faith appeal as a multicultural person, right? His parents were Italian. They emigrated to Argentina, and he himself has reached out across a number of different faith lines. He prayed with leaders from Israel and Palestine for peace in the Middle East, and he's made great ecumenical strides with the leader of the Greek Orthodox Church. He thinks that a person is a person, and that person is a reflection of God. So he wants relationships with people of all kinds.
He's also a little bit of a Pope celebrity, to be fair.
He is a global celebrity. Yeah. He recently said, you know, Jesus was popular too, and look how that turned out.
Oh,
he really said that?
He did.
Wow. So also the Pope has a sense of humor.
He sure does.
But he hasn't
a
gone
dark with, sense of humor. Yeah,
he hasn't gone without his criticism. So there are critics out there talking about his record on LGBT rights. You know, he has, I guess, a year where that he's just declared where women will be able to be forgiven for having abortions. And so he's not, I think there's a lot of progressives out there that are saying, well, he's not as progressive as you think he is. You know, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think first, for clarity's sake, the Year of Mercy is a year of mercy on a number of things. And one of the things he talked about was making it easier in the hierarchy and the bureaucracy of the church for a priest to offer absolution to a woman coming to confession or to a man who participates in an abortion coming to confession. Your politics on abortion aside, I think what makes Pope Francis incredibly attractive to many people is his emphasis on mercy and care. He meets the person first before he meets their ideas, their actions, their choices, and that makes people feel loved and known. I think the criticism that he's not a flaming liberal in the way we would define that in our country is fair. He is not an American progressive Democrat. His ideas are much broader and much bigger than that. He represents a centuries-old church that has ideas that don't always flow well with any particular political party. And again, like in our interfaith coalitions, if critics of Pope Francis can look to the things that they share, a sense of value for people, a belief that God is present in each person, then we can really make strides on making our communities more inclusive, even if there are points of disagreement.
And of course, I mean, he's got critics on both sides. We mentioned earlier the climate change deniers are no fans of this Pope celebrity. But that's not the only issue where he's been described as, you know, a socialist, right? Next up, they'll call him Muslim, right?
Yeah, right.
So just the last question for you today, Claire, and thank you for taking so much time to be with us, because we know how busy you are with Pope NATO. You know, people often assume that only conservatives respect the importance of religion in people's lives, but there's a long history of religious leaders being active participants in social justice movements. How do you think that progressives can do a better job of engaging the faith community?
I think the first step of better engaging the faith community is recognizing they're not two totally separate communities. Many people of faith have progressive political values. Many people who work at CAP and in our other coalitions identify as people of faith. And it's important to let everybody bring their whole self to this conversation. The other thing is, you know, going back to that culture of encounter, leading with the values. If we can agree that we care about low-income families, we care about the dignity of work, we care about women's and people of colors and LGBT people's rights, we can care immensely about the shared values across faith and among people of no faith that also value those things. And I think we can also resist media presentations of people of faith as all conservative, right? We can push back by lifting up the voices of progressive people of faith and highlighting the great work being done right now on a host of different issues by faith-based organizations.
Claire Markham, Outreach Manager for the Faith and Progressive Policy Initiative here at CAP. Thanks so much for joining us. We've been wanting to have you on for a while because you're fun and a great colleague. And good luck with all of the events and everything you're part of.
Thank you so much for having me.
To continue our special Pope in D.C. episode of Talk Poverty Radio, we're joined by Sister Simone Campbell of Network. We're also rejoined by Alan Pike of Think Progress for another episode of the Weekly-ish Worst. And finally, we'll be featuring a portion of an event held earlier this week at the Center for American Progress on what progressives can learn from the Pope.
Welcome back. This is Rebecca Vallis.
And Tracy Ross.
We're excited to be on the official bus, the bus of Nuns on the Bus fame, with Sister Simone Campbell. Thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio, Sister Simone.
Well, I think I should welcome you onto the bus. Yeah. Thank you for being with us. Great to be with you.
It's an honor to be on the bus.
Yeah. And you know, and before we dive into why you're here on the bus this time around, we actually wanted to start back in 2012 and how the Nuns on the Bus became an actual thing. And I wanted to read a quote from you because it came about because of Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney. And you wrote that the Ryan budget failed a basic moral test because it would harm families living in poverty. Can you tell us a little bit about what's really spurred the Nuns on a Bus from this budget and this Ryan Romney pairing?
I know. It was shocking. Paul Ryan said that his Catholic faith informed his budget, and everything I saw was the absolutely antithesis, the opposite of Catholic social teaching. So his budget cut food stamps, cut support for single parents, cut child care, cut everything, Medicaid. And so we said, this is wrong. And we'd been, you know, campaigning against it for a very long time because he'd been after it for 2 years before that. And then we had a little attention from the Vatican, and so we had a lot of press attention. And we said, well, how do we use this moment for mission? And I had too small of an imagination at Network, so we invited our colleagues together. And on May 14th, 2012, I even remember the date, we came together at our office here in D.C., and 35 folks. And by the end of the meeting, we were going on the road, pushing back against the Ryan budget and lifting up the works of Catholic Sisters. Because what most people didn't know is Catholic Sisters' works in community often have as their cornerstone federal funding. And what Paul Ryan was proposing would have undercut that key funding. And so we said, we got to make it abundantly clear. And then everybody told us that we had to go on a wrap bus. And I didn't understand what a wrap bus was. I was so afraid it referred to music. And I was not a fan of rap music. But then I found out it's the glorious wallpaper that's put on the outside of the bus. So it's a WRAP and not a RAP.
And
so,
it is glorious indeed.
Isn't it
looking
fabulous?
Around, I wish our listeners could see it. We'll take some pictures maybe. And we'll share them.
Well, especially the outside. Because the outside is the WRAP.
Yeah.
And then last year on our Turn Out the Boat tour. This is our fourth tour. And so on the Turn Out the Vote tour, we added, if you committed to vote, you could sign our bus. So this year it was, if you commit to bridge the divides and transform our politics, you can sign our bus. So now we have thousands of signatures on our bus. It's fabulous.
And will you unpack that a little bit for us? So this time around, your goals with this bus tour are about bridging the divide, as you said, and about dramatically changing the politics in this country. But it's an economic message that you guys are traveling around with in a large part, right?
Well, absolutely, because one of the biggest divides that we saw is in the economy, because we know that all of the recovery from the horrible recession has gone to people at the top, while people at the bottom are sinking farther and farther behind. I mean, that's wrong in the richest nation on earth. And Pope Francis, we took Pope Francis's message across the country and let people know the Pope's coming. And his message is, we have to have an economy of inclusion. that everyone needs to be involved. There needs to be dignified work for everyone. He has this radical idea that people should be paid enough so that they can have weekends off to be with their family and even enjoy leisure and a dignified retirement. Doesn't that sound shocking?
And downright socialist something.
Oh, my gosh. I believe that's capitalism at its best. Because what we know is everyone participates. That's what we're supposed to be about. But, I don't know, we also know there's human nature. And so Pope Francis says that because of human nature and because of greed that slips in, we need strong government regulation. And that offsets our greed. Because when we come together as a people, shine the bright light on what's going on, then we're our better selves. And that's what the role of government regulation is.
So you've been coming together as a people in 33 different stops on this tour in anticipation of the Pope's visit. And you're going to a variety of states. One of them that jumped out to me was Missouri, because we saw a lot of attention on Ferguson.
Absolutely.
And the St. Louis area over the past year. What kinds of events did you hold when you were traveling around the state?
Well, it was our first day in St. Louis was so powerful because we started in front of the courthouse where the Dred Scott decision was made, which we remember institutionalized slavery in our nation. And then behind it was the arch, the gateway to the West, which I said was the gateway to hope and the future. And so with that iconic piece, we went from there to see Mothers to Mothers. And the divide, we started in Missouri, in St. Louis, because of the divide about race. But we got to talk to this group called Mothers to Mothers, five of African-American women who were doing the courageous thing. They decided to, after Ferguson, they'd go and talk to white mothers about what they as African-American mothers have to worry about that white mothers don't. And we spent 2.5 hours with them, and they gave us the candor of their worry in a way that broke my heart but opened my eyes. It was a gift. We were all in tears. Everybody was crying, but it was so painful to hear their worry for their sons. And the one that really got me was when Amy, who's a college professor, said that she quizzes her boys, an 8th grader and a 10th grader, all the time about what you're going to do when the police stop you. It's not if,
it's when.
And so her quizzing includes, you keep your hands out of your pockets, your arms away from your body, you say yes sir, no sir, and you don't get any teenage attitude.
And I'm sure one of the saddest parts is they probably know that even if their sons do all of those things, that they're still at risk.
Well, that's what she said, because that her son, her 10th grader said, but I dress preppy, as if how they dress would protect them. And then she said her 8th grader recently had said to her, Mommy, how long is this going to go on? And she had to say to them, for the rest of your lives. And, I mean, it broke my heart. And so I've become this one-woman crusade for sharing that story so that I know I walk around in a white skin with white privilege, but I had no idea of that particular anguish. We've got to find a way forward. We've got to bridge that divide. It's we the people. It's not we the white people or we, you know, the really special people. But we have to see how each other struggles. And so that's some of the divides that we're trying to bridge.
Well, and obviously a lot of what you've talked about is a lot of the kind of broader race relations and really institutional racism conversation that we've been having in this country, largely sparked by Ferguson and awful tragic events that have been happening all too commonly in cities across the country. But of course, there is an economic lens to that as well, right?
Oh.
And one that is felt profoundly by people who are all too familiar with being stopped by the police, but being sentenced and thrown behind bars and then economically disadvantaged as families, communities, and a larger racial group as well.
Exactly. And the other piece that we heard in many places was about that when economics are so bad, people turn to selling drugs because it is more lucrative. They can make more money than they possibly can working minimum wage jobs. But then we also saw little glimmers of hope. We were just in Columbus, Ohio, and they had, it's so interesting, every place we went on the bus, all our cities, people would call out at our town halls what the divides were, that there were streets that everybody knew were the divides. And one of the divides in Columbus is the freeway that goes across. And strategically, when they put in a new, some new art center, they tore down bridges between the poorer part of town and the central city, so that folks had a harder time getting downtown. But recently, they've built new bridges. They built new bridges to connect the city. And that, to me, was a literal experience of trying to pull us back in together. And what happened with the divide with the bridges down, people couldn't get jobs in the central city because they couldn't get to work. We heard a lot of people that don't have cars, so they're trying to rely on public transit, but public transit stops at 8 p.m. They can't work late shifts. So they lose jobs because of that. We heard about some of the folks that their hours keep getting cut. In Kansas City, we heard from a woman who works for two home health agencies as an in-home care worker, so people can stay in their homes and live in dignity. But she says she can't live in dignity with the salary she's making. So on the weekends, she works 12-hour shifts to try to make up for not having enough money. And she told us last year she got hospitalized. It was the first vacation she'd had in a long time. And while she was desperately sick, she felt like, at least I can rest. But then she had to go back to work because she had no benefits. I mean, this is wrong in the richest nation on earth. Who are we that we don't provide for our people? So we're out spreading the word that Pope Francis says this is wrong. We got to do it differently.
And there were conservatives that said that they hope that Pope Francis doesn't speak to these issues because it's too political. And obviously,
he should talk. What they say is that he should talk about abortion as if that weren't political.
Right.
In our nation, that is totally political and totally code words. But here's the problem. What he's really going to talk about is this exploitation, that we take advantage of each other. And that's what we have to stop. And we have to quit trying to look for the cheapest pot. This is where I have to be converted. I'm a bargain hunter. And I have to be converted from searching for the cheapest possible price to look for the most just price. Mm. I'll pay more if I know people are getting just wages. And that's what we, the people, have to say. And then, so I'm advocating three virtues for the 21st century. The first is holy curiosity. Ask when you go into a store, are you getting paid enough to get by? Or are you making enough? The second is, once you find out the answer to that question, then we have a responsibility for sacred gossip so that we talk to each other. Do you know at that restaurant down the way, they're just getting $2.13 an hour and are dependent on tips? Or do you know in that restaurant, I was just in Seattle too on a side trip, but they're getting paid $15 an hour and their businesses are booming. Did you know that? And so share what we find out. And then the third virtue is for the 21st century is we each have a responsibility to engage in one specific action that we keep at for the long run. We can't do everything. And too often progressives or those of us that care about poverty get overwhelmed, so we don't do anything. So what we've got to do is stay engaged, stay active, and do one thing. And if I do my part, you do yours, then change happens.
So some of the visits that you've been making on these stops have been to food pantries and social service providers, the kinds of places that people who are in need turn to, and without which they might be in even more dire straits. Something, on the other hand, that we've heard a lot about from conservatives such as Paul Ryan is that the private sector and charities could just sort of step up and take on the burden of poverty in this country. We can just slash these programs like food stamps you mentioned in his budget. Yeah, they'll just pick up the slack. Is that what you're hearing and seeing when you make these stops?
Absolutely not. We were just at the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, which is one of the most entrepreneurial, innovative, amazing food banks ever. And if you ever get to do field trips, go check them out, because they've got this huge warehouse and they have changed their distribution from being primarily dried and canned goods to 60% fresh foods. It is amazing the work that they have done, but it's all done with this public-private partnership. And they had their board president, who's from Safe Flight Auto, and he introduced himself to me. And he said, oh, yes, I'm from Safe Flight Auto, and I work there, and I'm the president of the board, and I'm a Republican. But he was really quick to say, is we need everybody to solve these problems. And that's the part that gets missed. It's the public-private partnership. We were in We were just in Wheeling, West Virginia, and they're doing this Farm 17 on the side of a hill where they've got a food truck that goes around to low-income neighborhoods bringing fresh fruits and vegetables. And then on Wednesdays, it's a community-supported agriculture, CSA, where they get money for doing it. And then they travel around and sell their produce. In where were we? Indianapolis, they've got this wonderful farm where their mission is to bridge the divide between people and fresh food. And so in the low-income community there, they're making plots of land and getting people to learn how to grow. And it's a contribution from the Super Bowl. When the Super Bowl was in Indianapolis, they contribute something, some legacy gift. Well, they created this amazing center that has the farm as part of it right there in the central city. And so all the vacant lots, they're gradually making them more like little farms, and kids are learning to grow vegetables and eat them. What a radical thought. There was one kid who said, "Ooh, yeah, I like eggplant." And it was like, whoa, there's a sophisticated salad for me. But it's that kind of building things. But what we need is everybody involved in this. It's not either or, it's both and. And the Republicans, Democrats, we all know people need to eat. But here's part of the trouble. Is people using food stamps. The majority, more than half, have folks who are working full-time in their households, and that the real issue is wages. And so I think we have a choice in our nation. We either have a strong safety net that's a business subsidy so businesses can pay low wages and I get my bargains that make me happy, or we pay just wages and our folks can feed their families on wages. And that's the tension we're facing right now. I say people need to eat. Choose your way. But you got to make sure our people eat.
So a very different program from ours, Fox News,
yes,
has been talking a lot about you and other people of faith and
other controversial people like
I
you.
I know, yeah.
You're
could
a firebrand. Yeah, and so what do you think the misperceptions of people of faith who are progressive are? Because it seems like you're allowed to be conservative and a person of faith, but then once you're a progressive and a person of faith, they're calling into question your character. What do you think this means? Because from my perspective, there's always been religious leaders in
exactly.
social justice
movements. I mean, I believe Dr. King was a preacher.
Yeah, I think
so,
that's right.
And actually, he inspired me to do this kind of work. So, I mean, he's important in our history, and we got to go to the Civil Rights Museum in Memphis. But I think really the thing is we make them nervous. I think it's the moral conscience, and that they know something's wrong, and so the only way they can react is to try to reject it, try to undermine it. And there's a big conservative push right now in the church to undermine Pope Francis. And so I think a big part of the latest brouhaha about us going to the White House. I mean, it was so funny. They named, I think, 3 or 4 people. There's going to be 15,000 people at the White House. But they're trying to make a deal about 4 of us? I mean, really. But it must be they're so frightened. And fear is a crippling reality. But that's what we're trying to say on the bus, is that fear not. Jesus kept saying, fear not. Fear not. And if we can get them to relax a little bit, then we can bridge these divides. But it also points out how they really don't want to settle these issues. They want to have their power, they want to have their control, and they do it through fear, and they do it without concern for what's happening to the rest of our nation. In Topeka, we got picketed by Westboro Baptist Church. And
means you're doing something right.
I know. But I went over to try to talk to them. But they just kept quoting scripture at me. And what I realized later, I should
selectively quoting. Yeah.
Selectively quoting. They don't have John's epistle where God is love in their lexicon. But what I realized later is I shouldn't have started with scripture. I should have started with her family. Oh, is this your son? Could you introduce me? You must be kind of proud of him. I should have started with that instead. So the next time they pick at me, that's what I'm going to try.
Well, in our last question for you in just about 30 seconds, are there any, if you had to pick maybe of all the questions that you've heard from people and topics that you've heard raised on the road, what is the thing that you keep hearing that people want to hear from the Pope while he's here?
That they're not alone. That they have a champion in him. And if he just speaks from his heart to our people, they will feel heard. I mean, that's what the bus is. The bus creates community wherever we go, and that people feel welcomed in. That's what we want, is to be a part of the whole, so we the people can make a difference.
Sister Simone Campbell, thank you so much for hosting us on your bus. It's been a delight talking to you.
We look forward to bridging the divide with you further the next time we have you on the show.
I love it.
And
I look forward to it.
We need to go sign your bus
That's
now.
That's right.
Yeah, sign the bus, yeah. Please. Excellent. Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio. This is Rebecca Vallis.
And Tracy Ross, and we're here for another installment of The Weekly Worst with our friend Alan Pike of Think Progress.
Weekly-ish actually becomes weekly this time.
We're
doing two weeks in a row.
Don't get spoiled, America.
We apparently really like you, Alan.
We can take this all the way again.
For those tuning in for the first time, The Weekly Worst is when Alan comes with three stories related to poverty, and we vote which one was the absolute worst of the week.
And for our special Pope NATO episode, do we have any Popish stuff this week, Alan?
We do. I didn't even do that on purpose.
Oh,
it's just a mathematical reality at this point that half of the internet is made up of Pope.
That is
only
true.
Half.
Well,
I'd say
big
that's
internet.
A conservative estimate.
It's a mind-bogglingly large.
See, the other half is cats.
Amount of data.
What's your first story?
Yep. Cats. First, though, is J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon, who said that income inequality isn't really a problem worth addressing, in part because the middle class can afford iPhones. This was at a speech in Detroit to the Detroit Economic Club. And he was saying that instead of tinkering with how the fruits of American capitalism get distributed between people, we should be focused solely on economic growth, that growing more rapidly is the solution to the sociological tensions, the economic tensions that we're starting to see come out of this rampant and growing wealth and income inequality. And the problem with that is, of course, is that workers' share of the fruits of economic growth have been shrinking for more than a decade now, and that's in spite of ever-increasing productivity and other measures of how hard people are working. That hard work isn't returning the kind of prosperity and even security as a minimum standard that it used to in this country. So he was sort of denying that that's a problem at all and pointing to technology and the ready availability of
that's
gadgets.
Two of my favorite conservative tropes in one story is basically trickle-down economics and, look, working-class people have things, therefore there are no problems.
Well, but is he even really advocating trickle-down necessarily, or is he just saying we need to prioritize growth and it doesn't matter who benefits from it? Either way.
Yeah, he might not care. You're right. He might not care. I guess I was being
not
generous.
Not to interfere with your conservative trope listing there.
I was being generous and hoping that he thought, like, that'll fix the problem of the poors. But you might be right. He might not care.
He's on board. He's more or less on board with trickle-down from what I can tell of his public statements. Because why else would you be opposed to marginal increases in the top-end tax rates that people like him pay? Why would you be opposed to taxing investment income at the same rate that, you know, sweat income gets taxed?
Check,
those are the sort of frontline redistributive tools that we have, the clubs that are in America's golf bag right now.
Oh God!
To try to do something. About
Tune in next week for America's golf bag.
What's the second story?
I'm going to try to get bougier and bougier with my metaphors as we go along.
But for those of you at home, he's actually cleaning off his monocle as he's saying this.
It's a pince-nez. Thank you very much.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, that got said. So
So we will move on to the second story, Tracy, but I feel like I hijacked us by litigating whether it was trickle down or not. We can't lose sight of the fact that he's buying into the Robert Rector line of thinking that, oh my God, poor people have basic things that they need, and therefore they're not really poor. Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly. This is why I love coming on this show, because you guys know who Robert Rector is. and in the rest of my life, I'm just the crazy guy screaming about people like Robert Rector.
Running down the street screaming Robert.
I thought you were screaming at the pigeons.
All right, we gotta go to the second
story.
We'll
move on.
All right. A woman named Santa Bailey is hoping that the Pope will make time for her and hundreds of other workers at federal buildings in D.C. who are paid poverty wages for their labor in food courts and as janitors. Workers like Bailey, who miscarried last year in part because she works two jobs to make ends meet and spends 17 hours a day on her feet as a result, are employed by companies with federal contracts. And President Obama's issued an executive order to require such contractors to pay somewhat higher wages than they do now. But that order can only kick in when those contracts get renegotiated. So for the meantime, Bailey and hundreds of other people similarly situated are continuing to go on strike intermittently to call attention to their plight. And they've timed one of those strikes to coincide with the Pope's visit. And a couple hundred of them have sent him a letter formally requesting an audience.
Hi. Well, I really hope that the Pope gives her a shout out and shakes her hand. I don't even know what to say about this one. It's absolutely egregious.
It's definitely horrifying. It definitely also seems to speak to the values of people who are trying to follow the tenets of the church and being pro-life. And in this instance, that means supporting workers' rights. And this would have helped protect the life of the mother and the child that she wanted to have. But luckily, we're seeing a lot of people mobilizing in similar ways for marching to D.C. to advocate for workers' rights. So I feel like this visit's going to highlight a lot of stories like that, which is why I'm excited about the post-visit, but this is a sad story.
It's stories like this, right? I mean, this goes right along with the woman who was working four jobs and actually was sleeping in her car, and one of those jobs was Dunkin' Donuts, right? And she ended up dying.
Right.
Literally from exhaustion,
because
that's the reality of the American worker today. Is not, you know, some people might claim we just need to work more hours and work harder, right? Mm-hmm. That's the problem. But the reality is people are working harder than they ever have, and they're making less.
I think this type of story is especially important to me, mostly because we're I think conditioned to think of the plight of most workers, like somebody who works for a Dunkin' Donuts or a private company, as being caught up in this sort of remote, abstract set of decisions that's mostly being made by one set of faceless people in suits on behalf of some other set of faceless people in suits. These folks are employed with our money. This is taxpayer money getting routed via federal contract to people who mop floors and clean food trays. And in some cases, they might be wearing a Dunkin' Donuts uniform, like at the Union Station food court or whatever. But they're working for a food service company whose CEO is likely getting paid millions and millions of dollars every year. And they're left completely stuck. And it's being done with our capital, with our resources.
So we could talk about this one for a while, but I think we need to move on to the third story, although I don't know what's going to rival those two this week.
Right. So companies that promise to help you get out of student debt may, in fact, be scamming you, it turns out.
Yes!
Oh, well, here
good.
One.
This is one of my favorite ones.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau won a preliminary injunction against a firm called World Law Group that allegedly bilked $61 million in fees out of 21,000 separate people in violation of the law. And these are companies that are able to position themselves in between people who are struggling to repay their loans and the government itself, which already offers a variety of repayment options specifically tailored to folks who are struggling. You can get onto an income-based repayment plan, a variety of other highly under-enrolled systems that exist within the Department of Education to help people who are struggling to pay back their debts do so without falling into the laps of these companies. But if you go to Google and you put in "help me get out of my student loans," one of the top things that it's probably going to crop up is an ad from one of these companies. So the CFPB is taking a variety of actions to try and curb the ability of unscrupulous actors like that to tap in and play middleman and fleece people in this way. But it's something that's going on at a level that's honestly kind of hard to understand. This is a story that my colleague Casey wrote at Think Progress this past week that is very long and very detailed. I encourage people to go read.
I think this one got misfiled because this is the Weekly Best. I love the CFPB. They're doing hugely important work here, and this is every God. There's so many stories I can't even keep track anymore of just some of the horrific stuff. I wish I could use harsher language on this show. that these kinds of companies do. They literally are targeting veterans. Right. And other populations and going after them and trying to basically make them into customers and indebting them and in many ways allied with for-profit institutions.
I feel like every week we find a new company that we're like, oh, they're the new payday lenders. You know, we're seeing this in so many different ways, you know, just beyond education, that if you're poor in this country, there's somebody out there that's trying to take advantage of your vulnerability for their profit. And it's pretty disgusting and scary. So I'm glad, similarly, that we're cracking down on this.
And all this stuff comes back to inequality, you know, in the end anyway, right? Like, if you weren't in
inequality.
Such dire personal finance circumstances, it would be a lot easier to stop and think, you know, that sounds way too good to be true, and thus it probably isn't,
right,
and walk the other direction. But when you're, you know, when you're up against it, when your lights are getting cut off, when your phone's getting cut off, when you're talking about maybe having to move into your car and out of your apartment, it's a lot harder to maintain that kind of a standard.
Sure.
I wish the rules of Weekly Worst allowed me to nominate a fourth one. I feel like I'll get in trouble with Alyssa, who wants us to wrap. Well, if we're talking about people profiting off of companies, profiting off of poor people, right? I mean, the fact that now we've seen the rise of an industry that is profiting off of people who are on house arrest or in community supervision who have ankle bracelets that they're being charged hundreds of dollars a month for that they can't afford, and if you miss a payment, you go back to jail. So I'd say they're in the same camp as the industry here.
Absolutely.
But Alyssa's saying we have to take a vote.
So okay, so to recap, we've got Jamie Dimon saying there's income inequality is not a problem. Basically, we need growth, and everyone has iPhones, so they're doing just fine.
Seize the iPhones.
Then we have the fact that government-employed service workers are not being able to sustain themselves, and it's harmful to their lives. And we have these people going after vulnerable student loan holders. Mm-hmm. So, what? You know, you won last week, right? So
yeah,
I think you have to go first now.
I'd like to win again this week. Can we arrange that?
Well, let's see what happens.
Okay.
I've got mine in my head.
I'm going to have to pick Jamie Dimon, right? Because anybody who perpetuates the Robert Rector, oh my God, people have basic stuff, therefore they can't be poor by American standards narrative, there's a special place in somewhere warm and fiery for them. So I'm gonna pick that.
I think we're allowed to say hell on this program.
I didn't want to actually say there's a place in hell for Jamie Dimon. I feel like that gets personal.
There is actually a special place reserved for Jamie Dimon next to a fire in a very nice ski shop.
Thank you, Alan, for clarifying.
I assumed that was what you meant.
Taking my words out of context.
So,
Name's carved into a platinum Adirondack chair.
Well, believe it or not, Rebecca, I, too, was planning on voting for the Jamie Dimon comments.
Excellent.
Because, as I was saying at the top, one of my favorite things in the world is when people are like, oh, you have a TV and you have a refrigerator and air conditioning? Oh, my God. You are, you know, doing just fine. And I feel like that goes with the mobile phone as well, that we have to step back and say, what kind of country are we living in? Do we want people to be absolutely disconnected from fully participating in society in order to define them as being in need? And I think that because he is a powerful and influential person, his reckless comments are not going to actually help us address the real problems that workers in this country face.
As Linda Tirado, a friend of the show, often likes to say, what do we want? Poor people to die from foodborne illness because they don't have refrigerators?
Right.
Is that our goal?
Well, and also, you know, almost everything else has gotten more expensive, right?
Exactly.
Like it's gotten harder and harder to afford your rent. It's gotten, for a lot of people, up until a couple of years ago, it had gotten progressively harder and harder to afford basic health care. The things that
Education, retirement, all
the sort of core goods that make up economic security and the traditional American definition of working class prosperity have gotten further and further out of reach. And just because now, you know, we can all take selfies
Right.
Doesn't negate that reality, and it doesn't mean that income inequality isn't going to eventually threaten our democracy.
Is this your vote for also for Jamie Dimon, or are you going to throw in a
yeah, no, I'm also voting for Jamie Dimon.
Unanimity!
Yeah. Jamie and I have a special relationship, and
you
I really
ski
need
together,
to,
clearly.
Yeah. On that note,
one of our few unanimous votes for a weekly wars.
To be savored.
Yes. We're all winners this week.
Thanks, Pope Francis.
Yeah, look at us. He's bringing people together.
It's a new hashtag. I'm going to make it
hashtag thanks
trend.
Pope Francis.
That's the weekly worst.
Well, come back next time, Alan, when we invite you. Maybe next week. We'll see.
We'll see you soon. No commitments.
Bye, y'all.
To close out this special Pope in D.C. episode of Talk Poverty Radio, we'll be featuring some excerpts of an interesting conversation hosted at the Center for American Progress earlier this week on what progressives can learn from the Pope.
So I want to pick up on that phrase with you, Rudy, because she works so much on worker justice issues and a moral economy versus the global economy we have now, which is cutthroat, which is ruthless, which really discards people when they're no longer useful to the economy. And there are all kinds of complicated explanations as to the economy so complex, you know, people might not understand it, but that's the way it is. And that's not what the Pope says. And he talks about we need an economy that works for people. And can you just give us a glimpse or paint us a snapshot of what would that world look like, the kind of world he's yearning for in terms of workers and wages and even labor unions and all the rest. And then is there any place on earth that comes close to that, or is it just really completely still idealized?
Certainly. No, he's really gone out of his way to ask the question, who's serving who here?
Yeah.
And whose interest is being served? So the economy should be serving the interest of its people and the community. And he's coming to a place where you have workers that work in the U.S. Senate building or the U.S. Capitol that don't have enough to feed their families. We have the story of Charles Gladden that was widely publicized, who lives under a bridge. And every day he goes to work at the Senate building, serving the most powerful people in our government, yet he has relegated to a life of poverty. That's not what this country is about. That economy that he's a vital part of and the services he provides isn't serving him. So I think he's going to challenge us to look at people like Charles and other people throughout this country who are really challenged by the way our economy is structured and who it's structured to serve. That we need to look at it in a way in which not just as the stock ticker goes up and down, that be the measure of our success. What does our GDP look like? But the success and measure of our economy are whether or not people are getting educated. People are having enough to feed their family. Do people have health care? Is the quality of life better as the wealth of a country increases and better for all of us? And I think when he's going to, one of the things that we'll also hear is him to talk about how we have this huge gap of and the wealth in this country. And I'm hoping we hear about the huge chasm of inequality that we see. So those are some of the things that I think we'll be focused on through in this talk.
I don't think that society exists yet where we have an economy of inclusion, but we have a tremendous opportunity in the coming year to create an energy economy of inclusion with the Clean Power Plan. Every state is going to be making their carbon reduction plan. And it could be business as usual, right? The power players come together, everybody with the most money decides how to reduce the carbon targets, no matter who has to suffer for it. Or we could have a broad stakeholder conversation where we're not just trying to reduce carbon, we're saying, how can we use this new energy economy opportunity to create real energy equity, where we're doing green job training and we're creating lots of jobs to create clean energy? So I think we have an exciting time ahead of us in this next year.
Some conservatives, political and otherwise, are saying things like, who are Catholic, I take my orders and I follow the Pope on matters that are religious, but not on matters that are political. And they're making this split around the more conservative social, you know, values issue of reproductive rights and health, abortion, LGBT equality as the religion part of it. And then the rest, which is economic equality and climate change, well, that's political stuff. And on that, he's just another guy and I don't have to listen to him. How do we make that connection that there that these are values and these are religious issues as well? And it's not like something lives in this pot and the other lives in the other pot. How do we connect that or get that message out?
I mean, to your point, I mean, I think we're in a very unique moment. I mean, Jeb Bush responded to the encyclical with that quote.
Yeah.
And he was actually called out by Cardinal Peter Turkson, who heads the Vatican Pontifical Council of Justice and Peace, on CNN, saying, hey, no, we can't, that's not how it works. You can't pick and choose, right? If you're going to talk about your faith in the public square, let's have the robust discussion about it. And I think, you know, Pope Francis is not a politician, but he certainly is opening up new space for a different kind of Catholic political narrative in this country. And there are some bishops who are excited about that, too. The Pope appointed a bishop in San Diego a few months ago, Robert McElroy, who wrote a stunning piece in America Magazine where he called, in his words, not mine, for a transformation in the Catholic political narrative. So, you know, I think, again, this Pope is reviving something old in the Church's teaching, which is the common good, this idea of a broader moral values debate. And that certainly puts some Republicans who are sort of, I think, been used to owning the political narrative in this country in a tough spot.
One of the other appointments that he recently made is the Archbishop of Chicago, Bishop Supich.
Right, Supich.
And he just recently, I was at an event where he said some very important things around the church's relationship to workers and to labor. I mean, essentially, he went as far as saying, not just we're with you in solidarity with what labor stands for and what it's about, but he even went further and he said that right to work legislation is not in sync with Catholic teaching. And to be able to say something like that and take that kind of stand, I think it's not just courageous, but also getting to a values question. He's saying, look beyond the letter of what it's saying and the impact of what it's having on people. And when we look at those values and we look at their overall effect, that should be the judge as to whether or not we're compelled to act or we feel that we're connected to it in that way.
If I could pick up on Rudy's point, you know, the Pope's critics see him as a Marxist, right? He's not a Marxist. He's Catholic. I mean, he's really...
Is the Pope Catholic?
He's Catholic. I have it on record. You know, he is really reviving something that's been lost in the Catholic conversation in the public square, which, I mean, the Catholic Church has been for living wages, you know, since 1891. And we have, you know, members of Congress who are Catholic still trying to figure out, should we pay workers a living wage? And so he's revitalizing that conversation in a way that we have not seen in a while. And I think that has a political impact in terms of how we think about values debates in American politics.
And right to work laws gets pretty specific. Go ahead. Okay. I'm sorry.
Well, and because I think he's being successful, which goes back to your question about does popularity matter?
Yeah.
People are getting nervous and asking all kinds of questions about the relationship between church and state. My favorite response comes from Martin Luther King, that the church is not the master of the state, not the servant of the state, but the conscience of the state.
And also, in addition to, you know, to your point, John, of Catholic social teaching, which a lot of Americans don't know because it's been so tamped down, the very role of government as a good thing is also key. And if that can be injected into the debate from a values point of view, could be transforming as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we've had an anti-government ideology in this country for at least, you know, since the Reagan Revolution. I mean, the Catholic Church sees government as a good, you know, certainly with limits, and the idea of subsidiarity and community development is part of that. But, you know, this is a Pope who also challenges sort of the political orthodoxy that the markets can take care of everything. And so, you know, he's not anti-market, but he wants to ground the market in a more humane context. And I think that's very traditional Catholic teaching again.
Well, I want to ask, and Rudy, you can start with this, to pick up on that, a question about capitalism, because we hear, again, not critics of the Pope, but people sort of saying, well, the Pope, you know, he's not an economist, and he may be a little naive in this area. And what he doesn't quite understand is that the free enterprise system, that's the driver that has lifted people out of poverty globally. So if you want to reduce poverty, this is the system that has really done it, and don't tinker with it. And so how do you respond? You're already smiling as if I'm like telling a joke. How do you respond with a straight face, I mean, to that criticism, which is, you know, a legitimate thing that a lot of people say?
So, again, it's not about going after capitalism, although there needs to be, as there are limits on governments, limits on markets, right? The idea of people serving the market is one that has led to the greatest income disparity that we've had in this country, where we see the chasm between the rich and poor be at its greatest in decades. We see the effects of what he called unfettered capitalism.
Unfettered, right.
So that's the message here, that anything left unchecked, anything that we put too much faith in, is not a good thing. And what he challenges us to do is to be able to look at the effects of not just this is having us on our own person, but on those around us.